welcome to The C Word, the Conservators podcast. Today we have a takeover special.
Welcome to the Natural History Museum. We have all the cool things, come and see them. Dinosaurs, fossils, animals too. Insects, rocks, it's like a zoo. Cromwell's dinosaurs, ammonites too. Cromwell's dinosaurs, ammonites too. Cromwell's dinosaurs, ammonites too.
Hi everyone, my name is Bethany Palumbo and I'm Head of Conservation at the Natural History Museum in Denmark. I lead a team of natural history conservators. Natural history conservation is quite niche. In our field, it's a pretty small group. And when the opportunity presented itself to do a podcast takeover on the C Word, we jumped at it because it's not often we get to share our small field with other conservators. And we have plenty of what some might consider to be strange sort of things that we get up to in our day-to-day work. A little bit about me. Well, foremost, I'm a mum of two beautiful boys. I'm a musician when I find the time. But most of my days are spent working as a natural history conservator, and I've been working in natural history museums for some time now. What got me into natural history was just a love of nature. I always loved animals and being outside. And as a conservator, I love the materials, fur and feather, and skeletons. And I just love to be in the natural history museums anywhere I've visited. I'm so grateful too that I got to turn this passion into my full-time job. My time in Copenhagen has been focused on our new museum project. It's not often that there is an entirely new museum built in the very centre of a busy European city. This project is really special. Our new museum is due to open in a year or so. It will have around 7,000 square metres of display space, and my team is responsible for preparing all of the objects for the many galleries. It's been busy and we have just so much to tell you. Honestly, we could talk for days. We decided to divide this into two separate episodes. In the first episode, the team and I explore what it is to be a natural history conservator. We talk about our experiences in the field, being an international, training opportunities, where and how we trained, and then we have a bit of a conversation about the ethics of collecting and where there's still room for improvement. We move on to focus on specific objects that we've been preparing for the exhibitions, and I'll be talking to curators, collections managers, and conservators along the way. Now, because in natural history museums we talk in quite a different language to our conservation peers, I thought I'd just give a little glossary of terms at the start here to sort of help listeners understand a bit better what we're talking about. Natural history museums generally use a lot of biology lingo. The collections are divided up by kingdom, so animal or plant, and then class, so mammals as an example, and then into genus and species such as bears and black bears. Our collections come from the field out in the world and are collected usually by the curator or researchers specialising in that species or location. These materials are then preserved and stored in the museum for research and display. Some materials require no preservation, such as geology, that encompasses rocks and minerals. Others are dried, like plants and insects. Other animals are taxidermied, which is when the skin of an animal is tanned and mounted over a form to replicate the animal in life. And many animals are also preserved in fluid, this means in jars of formalin or ethanol. Our work covers a lot of different materials preserved in many different ways, but it's our job to ensure all these different types of collections are safe and preserved for the future. Well, we really hope you enjoy this podcast. It's been such a joy to record it for you. And if you want to get in touch, you can find me on Instagram or LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from you. Enjoy. It's happening.
Okay, yeah.
Welcome to the team. Thank you, everyone, for agreeing to participate in this. Let's go around the group and introduce ourselves. Nicole.
Hi, I'm Nicole. I am a conservator here at the Natural History Museum of Denmark. I've been here 3 years, originally from the US, where I got my training at the Conservation Center, Institute of Fine Arts, NYU.
Hi, I'm Anastasia. I'm from France and I've trained in France and in the UK. And I've been working here almost for 3 years.
And my name is Mikkel. I studied here in Copenhagen at the Institute of Conservation, and I have a bachelor's in natural history conservation and a master's in general conservation, graduating in 21 and starting here in 23.
Nice. That leads me straight on to the next thing I'd love to talk about, which is the fact that here in Copenhagen there is in fact training, a formal training for natural history conservation. Tell us more about that experience, Mikkel, and what that looked like.
Well, it's in conservation, so it's obviously a small school. It's an institute founded in 73. Four tracks, what I in English would call objects conservation or archaeology conservation, arts conservation, graphics conservation, and natural history conservation.
How long has the natural history conservation unit there been running for?
That's a really good question. It's fairly new.
I mean, like
yeah,
the last 20 years.
It's the youngest of the four branches at the school. So it's a relatively new branch at the school.
For me, it was the training was seeking out your own experience. I was at the University of Lincoln, and both for my bachelor's and my master's, my lecturers were very upfront. They were just saying to me, "We don't have the experience in this. It's very niche. Go out into the world and find your own training opportunities." What about you, Nicole? How did you come into natural history?
Great question. So I started...
Are you glad that you're in natural
history? So glad I'm in natural history. I started off in fine arts objects, and basically my program is quite small, so we can cater our interests a bit. So I asked to have a natural science course because they had done it a few years prior and had like great reviews for it, and I thought it was so cool. And so I had two conservators, one from AM&H and one from...
What is AM&H for those who don't know?
Sure, American Museum of Natural History, and then one from NPS, which is National Park Service. And they together taught a course on natural science conservation where I absolutely fell in love.
Nice.
And was able to then cater my experience towards that.
Cool. Nicole, what was it in that course that you, in that short, so you had a, what was it, like a semester of natural history conservation training, and what did you cover in that semester?
We did general stuff, so a bit of everything, and then we would be assigned two objects to work on. So I had a shoulder mount, so it's just the head that's put on a wall, like a trophy mount. That had shattered, and it was probably the hardest treatment I did my entire 4 years.
This was taxidermy?
Taxidermy. And it was just so incredibly cool because you're working with inorganic and organic materials at once. And there's also an art to the taxidermy form, as well as having something that is in natural science. So together, it was a really cool combination.
Yeah, taxidermy is something we've been focusing a lot on in our new museum project. There's both collection specimens that need to be restored and lots of new specimens that we've been purchasing. And that's something that's quite common in natural history museums, is the acquisition of new specimens for display. Anastasia, I'd love to learn more about your training and how you also ended up in natural history, not coming from a natural history background.
Yeah, so I didn't see it coming, really. It kind of
hit you like a bus.
Yeah. So I didn't even know, really, that conservation was a career when I picked my university training for my bachelor. So I did art history and archaeology, and then I realized that conservation was a thing, but I only knew about paintings. I think that's the like, main one. So I did 1 year after my bachelor of... training in workshops in Paris, doing some painting conservation, some copying of painting, practicing my English because I wanted to go study in England. And then I went to Lincoln, like you did. And there, it's a general like object degree, it's not specialized. But the objects get assigned, and then you can say yes or no if you really don't want an object. And the student before me got assigned an entomology box,
What is that for those
so
who don't know?
A box with a lot of insects, like pinned insects, and in that case there was also like a big tarantula in the box. So the student didn't want to do it. And,
were they afraid or
yeah,
overwhelmed?
Like,
or
disgusted a
okay,
bit,
right.
I think. Well,
disgusted.
I don't want to work on the tarantula. Like,
okay.
This is not what I signed up for. I want to do objects. And so I was next in line, and I thought it was really cool. I was like, yeah, sure, give me the tarantula. And then I just really fell in love with it, fell in love with the materials, the ethics behind it, the combination of working on an historical object, but it's also a scientific object.
Yeah.
And then I just kept asking for more things like that. So I got like diorama of some waterfalls.
Mm-hmm.
I got some birds, and I just kept doing it. But a bit like you, it was more I asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
And after my master's, I ended up doing taxidermy courses and conservation of natural history courses, like the fluid preservation course,
mm-hmm.
and things like that, because that was not something I could learn at university.
Yeah.
That's something I had to do on my own.
How many years after me were you there? Because I feel like when I was there wasn't even natural history objects that you could choose from.
I graduated in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a few years later.
So a few years after.
Yeah.
But it was clearly not like the main thing.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I thought I would actually do gilding.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was my favorite thing. And that's why I did my internship.
Very
was,
therapeutic.
Yeah, like
lovely.
Completely different. So yeah, not really an option that I had considered until quite late.
Mm-hmm. Are you happy with your decision now to specialize
yeah.
in it?
Yeah, yeah, very happy.
It's
I wanted
a mad
to be
bunch
a,
of people.
It is a mad bunch of people, but I think that works for me, and I wanted to be a vet, like, my whole life.
I did, too.
As a kid, and it's like, well, I used to work with
great.
Animals, you know?
I just didn't like snakes, and I didn't like the idea of animals dying.
Mm.
So
but
I prefer already them
already
dead.
And you're not going to be a good vet, to be honest. That's
yeah,
the whole thing,
I'd be
right?
a terrible vet, but if they're already dead, I guess it's fine.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I know quite a few people who came from that. We just wanted to be close to nature.
Yeah.
But we were also artistic.
Yeah.
And it was finding a way to bring those two things together.
Yeah.
At least that's what it was for me.
Exactly.
Okay, so what are some of the specific issues that we encounter in the natural history museums when compared to other museum collections? The first, I would say, is collecting in the field. The majority of the specimens here have been collected from the wild, are all naturally sourced from nature. And yeah, I think that compared to other museum collections, which may be dominantly art or human ethnographical objects, human collections, social science collections, etc.
Do you mean that a natural history museum usually has a very active collection? Like, for example,
yeah.
a whale gets stranded on a beach and then it arrives at the museum and you didn't expect it? Or
yeah, I'm
yeah.
waiting for the day that the whale arrives. I can finally be a part of that. But yeah, I'm just talking more about how our sourcing, our object sourcing,
mm.
and how it is very, very active.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is the main point in natural history museums.
Yeah.
We are continuously collecting objects.
Yeah, and the history of collecting is also very valued.
Mm-hmm.
So the specimen comes with that history attached to it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. A specimen without its data kind of loses like
yeah.
most of its value.
Can you elaborate on what data, what that means for a scientific specimen?
So the day it was collected, the place it was collected, who collected it, what is the species' scientific name, and I guess any additional features. So for example, here at the museum, we get a lot of specimens from the Copenhagen Zoo.
Yeah.
And those animals and are very different than the same species in the wild.
100%.
So if we add the same, we just said, oh, it's a tiger skeleton, and we didn't know where that tiger skeleton came from, we would not be, like, it wouldn't be scientifically accurate to pretend that a tiger skeleton from the zoo is the same as one from the wild.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, and data could be all the samples that are taken.
Yeah.
So we also have our frozen collections
mm.
of all the samples of all the dry animals or animals that would end up in fluid.
This is DNA samples, yeah? DNA
that,
samples.
Well,
tissue
samples that tissue would
samples.
Be used for DNA and probably in the future for other testing methods we haven't even thought of yet,
mm.
which we have to conserve material for.
Yeah. And that's why, too, in minimal intervention in our field is very important. We at least in the project we're doing now, the priority is display objects. We're just working on the exhibitions And for us as a museum of science, it's paramount that the Natural History Museum specimens on display represent closely what they are in nature. That will help the visitor to, you know, learn about that species, how to identify it, what it looks like, etc. But for collection specimens, we don't do many treatments on collection specimens.
No, because if you want to be able to do a sample, you don't want to sample something that's been treated and coated with an adhesive or anything, or overly cleaned, or it's important to not have too much treatment on a research specimen. Yeah. And I know you've had a tiger shark skull.
Yeah, so I had a tiger shark skull that basically a lot of the pieces had kind of shattered and broken off, and it was from sampling. And because the value didn't lie in how it looked, but actually what it could provide in terms of research, it was fine for the shark skull to look like that.
And tell me about how did it look, this shark skull, with the samples removed?
So basically the outer cartilage layer was peeling back and breaking, and it would reveal an inner cartilage layer. So it looked...
It didn't look so good.
It didn't look so good. Yeah, I'm trying to find a polite way of saying it looked bad.
It had lots of holes drilled into
lots of holes, lots of breakage, lots of huge pieces lying on the ground. But I think because it was then selected for display, with the approval of a curator and telling him that, like, this will no longer be able to be used for sampling.
Okay.
Is it okay? I was able to put it into a more cohesive form.
Yeah, so the curator approved that it would not be used for the research.
It's really important in our field that we get approval from the stakeholder, which in this case is usually the curator.
Yeah.
And we always inform them that any treatment we do will alter its value in terms of research or whatever. And we make sure that they're aware of that before we do anything.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd like to... When we work on exhibit items, I like to differentiate between objects and specimens. Because specimens is what we would use for research. And the shark skull you mentioned, Nicole, had been treated as a specimen, but it's actually also a historical object. It was already flensed or prepared as an osteological preparation, which means that it's mounted in a natural position as a skeleton, but was still used for destructive sampling, which is different to, let's say, having the cartilaginous bones frozen or in spirits or whatever. So it's just like
it's
the approach to a specimen where when we prepare all of these objects for exhibition, we have to treat them as objects, as a conservator. There's limits to what we want to change.
I would actually disagree with you in the sense that some of the things that we do put on display can be used for research still.
No, for sure.
So we never are shutting that off. It's still an active collection that is on display. So I still like to refer to them all as specimens.
I always just refer to them as specimens because that's the language of the museum.
No,
A few times I've called them objects. And curators have been like, hold up.
An object if it's a model, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Otherwise, I always say specimen.
Yeah, I know. And I probably do day to day, but it's...
But maybe it's also different in Danish versus English.
Well, that's the thing, like, we'll get into that. Yeah, for me, it's like semantics in English. I think it's quite interesting. No, for sure, we would never, a part of what we do. We don't want to make it so that you can't use the specimen because it's still a specimen. But we also get a lot of what the curators give us of specimens is specimens that they deem to have lesser value, meaning they
display,
don't have data.
They
will be part of the exhibitions collections, which is specimens with no data.
And another thing I was going to say about display, sometimes, you know, talking about the restoration of the specimens / objects for display is that the restoration can be really interventive and remove, you know, scientific potential. But that's important to establish that before you start. So a few times I've been treating an object and I've communicated with the curator and we've come to an agreement about what that treatment should look like. And they have come and sampled the specimen before treatment starts. So at least they have the samples that they need to prevent any confusion in the future. Another thing I'd love to talk about is fresh preparations. So this is something we are doing for our new museum exhibitions. We are acquiring new taxidermy, and we are preparing new fluid specimens, and we are preserving how many plants, Anastasia? What's this list looking like?
I think at the moment we're on 120, but some of the lines of the spreadsheet are like 100, like 4-head clovers or something.
Yeah. So lots of new herbaria sheets, which is a dried plant that will be pressed onto a sheet of paper, and we're trying to preserve some plants in 3D.
Trying.
Yeah. So knowing how to make fresh preparations is a big part of the job as a natural history conservator, no?
Yeah. I guess conserving fresh material, opposed to, conserving old, dried, relatively stable material. We have to conserve it.
Is that something you learn about in your degree at the Royal Academy in Copenhagen?
A lot of my bachelor's was field collection and archaeological conservation, which means usually stabilizing it and bringing it home to a controlled environment where we can then do the actual conservation.
I think that's where Denmark differs probably from the rest of most of the conservation trainings that I know of, because in France and in the UK at least, when you do a conservation training, you know the theory of preparing a new specimen, but you're never asked to do that. No. So when I conserved my entomology box, when I conserved my taxidermy mounts, I had to research how they were made. I had to research what is usually used for a mannequin, what products I use, what is this, what is that, is there a risk for arsenic, and all of those things. But I was never expected to know to do it myself. And then when I did, I've learned how to do insect pinning, and I've learned the very, very basics of taxidermy, but I did that on my own. And that was not expected of me to graduate as a conservator. And I think it's the same for you in the US.
Yeah, I can say that it is exactly the same. But I also think that has to do with the fact that maybe only in Denmark do they have a master's specialized in natural history conservation.
Yeah.
I think the rest of us had to really cater our education to fit into this world.
Okay, so now let's just talk a bit about... That's enough about our museum and all the mad stuff we've got to get done. But natural history conservation as a specialty. So I've been in this field for about 15 years now, and I have seen it grow substantially in that time. When I graduated, knowing a handful of conservators who were mostly based in the US and a couple in the UK, I can now see very regularly jobs being advertised for natural history conservators to move into teams where they have the other expertise, paintings, paper, ethnographic, etc., but they're lacking the natural history knowledge. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's definitely growing.
Yeah. I can see that museums are starting to value this as a specialty.
Sure. Yeah.
Versus having an objects conservator handle taxidermy or fluid collections or fossils, having a specialist who is trained in these objects, their materiality, etc. And the next question is sort of how and where do we fit into the field? As Anastasia was saying, you walk into a conference in a room full of conservators and you're sort of alone in your specialty. Objects groups will have hundreds of members, ceramics, buildings, etc. I love the fact that there's maybe 25 of us in the world who have connected through. If anyone's interested, there are two amazing natural history museum and collection societies. One is called SPINACH, the Society for the Preservation of Natural History Collections, and NATSCA, which is the
Natural Sciences Collection Association.
Thank you, Anastasia. It's not that I've been involved with them for the last decade. No problem there. And if you're interested in natural history museums, natural history conservation, these are two great societies to join, because that's where we find our people.
Yeah, definitely. But I think it's also important to remember that because natural history, it's not just one type of material. Like, there are many materials, sometimes even within the same object.
Yeah.
you actually can get very interesting insights and relevant ideas from different fields. So I've been to a textile conference and was inspired by some treatment. You can draw on from paper conservation, from art conservation, and just look at it, like, try not to look at your object just as a natural history object, but as what is this made of, and how can I learn from, oh, it's an ethnographic fur coat, it was treated this way, and maybe I can apply this treatment, at least partially, to my taxidermy mount.
Yeah.
Anastasia shared with me an article from a paper conservator making faux fur mm-hmm. with Japanese tissue paper,
Ooh.
And it ended up being the answer to my treatment for no copy.
Yeah. There's definitely so much to be learned from other fields, especially because our field is so small. And to be honest, within a natural history museum, there's usually one single conservator. It's very rare that there would be a team of people.
We're a very big team. Mm.
There's no time for research. We're not going to have time or resources to do this research ourselves. Let's reach out to our colleagues in other fields.
Material research is definitely where
In terms of materials.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the adhesives, the paints we use, they're all conservation focused. So like all of my training in fine arts objects is really applied to natural history.
Mm. I feel it's more a difference in approach sometimes. Like when I've worked on ethnographic collection, I think the curators would be a bit more mindful and would very much push for minimal intervention. And even cleaning was debated a bit more. And in Natural History Museum, not just here, but in general, I feel the approach is a bit different, at least when it's, again, a display specimen. It's a bit more open to the idea of cleaning and interventive treatment.
Hmm.
Do you think that will change over time as the specialty becomes more mainstream?
Maybe. I think some
things... We can absorb some of those ethics from other conservators.
I think some standards will change and for the better. Because I feel at the moment, natural history collections have been a bit undervalued, probably.
100%.
There's not enough funding, there's not enough recognition. I don't think the general public also understands, maybe, necessarily what it involves to put a specimen on display and to prepare it, and the amount of work and the expertise. Like, taxidermy is incredibly difficult, and to have a beautiful taxidermy mount, you need a lot of skills. But that takes time and money.
That's why we can't just replace everything.
No, definitely
I feel like that's been in the culture a lot.
Yeah.
That we, you know, we have these specimens, we've collected them, we've used them for our research, and now they're sort of disposable, we can always get more.
Yeah.
But we're getting to a point where we can't get more.
Yeah, I think part of the allure of natural science for me is the ethics behind it. And pushing for better ethics. Dioramas, for example, are an art form that I think is getting lost.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to a diorama besides the habitat and the animals inside. And I think it's just a really cool field when you get both science and art in so many forms, and historic value and market value. There's so much behind it.
But it's also a weird discordance between, like, when you say it's not throwaway culture, but it's replacement culture in the exhibitions.
It's
a bit discordant with natural history collections and museums being built upon natural conservation, being like they being researchers, zoologists. Botanists starting to collect nature because they saw it dwindling and they saw it disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
They collected to preserve something they knew wouldn't be replaced. And still some researchers want to freely replace. Obviously, as an institution, we work against that. But it's just a weird... Yeah. It's
That's what makes it fun.
Yeah. Fun. That's true.
I think that's a good conversation. Yeah. I think that's been a good conversation to have. That wasn't on here, but I'm glad it came up.
Yeah.
Well, thank you everyone for your time. It's been great to chat. For the next part of this podcast takeover, we'll be walking around the museum and talking to the team as they have been preparing objects for the new exhibitions. Cromwell's dinosaurs and the next two. Cromwell's dinosaurs and the next two.
So now I've walked into the atelier, which is our conservator's workshop, where my team is based. I can see around me all kinds of creatures. We've got taxidermied crows, some skeletons. And I'm also joined by curator Mark.
Hello.
Schertz.
Mark Schertz, yes,
who
that's me.
Is our curator of?
I'm the curator of herpetology.
Mark, what does that mean?
I study reptiles and amphibians.
Reptiles and amphibians. What are we talking? Frogs, lizards?
Frogs, lizards. My speciality are the reptiles and amphibians of Madagascar.
Okay.
So all of the frogs, none of the salamanders, no Sicilians, none
why,
of the silly
why not?
Ones.
Are they in their own group?
They're just not there. Just not in Madagascar.
Oh, in Madagascar.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you meant they weren't in your research.
No, I mean, I would accept them if they, you know, come across my path.
Nice.
But, you know, as curator, I'm responsible for those things, but I don't actively study them necessarily.
What is this amazing specimen that I'm looking at?
Yeah, this is a leatherback. We wanted to give it a name, actually.
A leatherback what?
Oh, a leatherback sea turtle. Pardon the jargon. This is a leatherback sea turtle. So leatherbacks are the largest extant sea turtles. They're much smaller than the extinct cousins, but they are still big beasties.
Oh, yeah, huge.
This one is about, what is it, like 1.60 meters or something?
Yeah,
roughly. It's a bit bigger than you.
Would you call it a flipper span?
Yeah, the wingspan we can call it, because their flippers act a bit like wings as they push themselves through the water. The flipper span is a bit longer than the turtle is, broader than the turtle is long, and is also something like, it's bigger than me, I guess. So it's like 190 to 2 meters or so.
Big. These turtles are huge.
They're pretty big. And this is a pretty big specimen we've got. And this one has a really fun story.
I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. So it wound up, it's kind of a surprising one, because we know a little bit about it before it wound up on the Danish shore.
Okay.
So there was a report of people encountering off the coast of the Netherlands a sea turtle swimming in the water, a leatherback sea turtle swimming in the water, that had a big open wound on its head.
Ouch.
So it looked like it had been whacked by probably the blade, the rotor of a speedboat or a boat of some kind. And then I guess people kind of lost track of it, but we knew that it was up in these waters. And then suddenly this specimen washed up on the Danish shore, and it was actually found by a group of kindergartner kids.
What?
So like teeny tiny kiddos.
Wow.
And their teachers found it on the beach over in western Denmark, made all the headlines.
For me, that is the jackpot find.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I go beachcombing, and I'm like super happy if I find, I don't know, like a shell that's not the usual one, you know. But yeah, if you find a whole, like absolutely freshly dead sea turtle on the shore, that's the dream.
Is it, are sea turtles common in this part of the world?
No, so we don't have a lot of leatherbacks, and actually there's a bit of a bad situation going on right now where we are getting a lot of sea turtles washing up on our shore.
What is causing that?
We have no idea, but probably related to currents. Maybe things are just weirdly cold. The animals die of cold shock, so they come into the Danish waters or into the, you know, the Nordic waters, Baltic Sea, bloody cold, and then
so cold.
Yeah,
I've been in there a few times.
Yeah, yeah,
it's pretty chilly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even on a nice warm time, like
still
right now,
cold.
The water is as good as it's going to be for
icy.
The rest of the year. It's pretty cold, like chilling. And so the animals get into those cold currents, and then they get a shock, and then they die. And we think that's probably what happened with our leatherback as well. But we have this unique story that we know where it was before it wound up washed up on our shore. And when it washed up, it was in beautiful condition. And so the Natural History Museum of Denmark is responsible for all large marine animals that wash up on the shore. So when they wash up, there's actually like a whale hotline, because we get a lot of whales. Denmark is a small country with relatively a lot of coastline.
Yeah.
There's basically a hotline where the people can call, and it scrambles the team. And so various people from our museum were scrambled out to go to the west of Denmark to go and help with the dissection. And that was actually, I think, live televised.
Wow.
You can see parts of the footage, I think, online. And there's all these news stories as well about this same specimen that was that washed up. So we know a lot about that history. And then eventually it was being kept in a freezer over there. And then just after I started, it was about 4 years ago, we were like, okay, we'd like to actually have the turtle here. And so I began to campaign that actually this beautiful leatherback that we have in the freezer would be an excellent so-called star object that we could have on display. It will be large enough to be very impressive. It has a Danish story. It's from Denmark. So it kind of, and leatherbacks, they nest in the on tropical beaches. They do occasionally visit in the north, and then sometimes they swim back down. This one happened to die on our shores in stormy weather. And so it kind of tells the story of the connection between these parts of the world. So it's doing that story job. And so, yeah, then we sent it to have it taxidermied.
We did, yeah, and it's arrived back taxidermied. And I would say the positioning of the specimen is something very unique.
Yeah.
I've never
That's also
seen
something I leatherback, pushed for.
Yeah, leatherback turtles, taxidermy ones I've seen in other museums have been almost like they're on the beach laying eggs.
Yeah.
Very flat, undynamic.
Absolutely.
But this specimen, we really wanted it to look like it was actively swimming and also have its mouth open, because the leatherback turtle has a very unique throat lining.
Yeah.
Which
so,
you're welcome to go. I mean, it's terrifying to see.
Yeah.
If I could
if you can think of the Sarlacc pit from Star Wars.
Basically, yes.
It is a Sarlacc pit.
Yeah. The objective is, of course, that jellyfish go in and they can't get out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So this is actually something we see across a lot of the sea turtles. They all have these little spines. In leatherbacks, they're the longest and thinnest of all of the turtles. That gives them this really spiny, bizarre appearance. And the function of these is that these turtles eat mostly jellyfish and other soft-bodied animals. And it's quite an ingenious system, because as they eat those things, they're swallowing a lot of seawater. And so they need to spit that seawater out, but they don't want to lose the jellies. And so what they wind up doing is that the jellies, or whatever it is, gets caught on those spines, and then the water can be spat out without losing your food object. Brilliant. But unfortunately, plastic bags and jellyfish are really, really similar.
They are.
And like jellyfish, plastic bags will get caught on those spines.
We did actually find some plastic inside the specimen.
Exactly. There were a few pieces of plastic bags and some other objects that were inside the gut of the specimen. And probably those aren't the primary factor that killed the turtle. I can't say that for sure, but the very fact that it came into these very cold waters was probably weakened, had a big head wound. The head wound is healed, so it's not like a very fresh wound.
No.
But the turtle is not having the best time in the world. And then the other decision that we took was to preserve the head wound.
Yep.
Because it tells the story of the human-animal interaction that is so important to this kind of the choice of this object on display, the messages that we're trying to convey. So it's very much a decision about how do we want to tell the story. We could have covered that bit up and cast it as though it had a whole head, but in the end it winds up being a much more compelling and somehow relatable story, I think, for the museum guests. It's certainly on the verge of gruesome, so, you know, people are going to be maybe a little bit squeaked out by it.
Respectfully, though, nature is gruesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. And our interactions with nature should not be glossed over and beautified. Like, the very fact that this is a wound that is almost certainly human-inflicted tells us a lot about, like, human-animal interactions and kind of the symbolism of what the object is supposed to do in the context of the gallery that we're kind of designing around it.
Mark, tell me more about the gallery that the specimen is going to be showcased in.
Yeah, so it's going into what's called the Biodiversity Gallery. And our goal with the Biodiversity Gallery is to showcase, essentially, the diversity of life on Earth and the connections that exist among that diversity, how humans are a part of that story, and that there's a lot of human-animal interactions, but also that animals, plants, and humans kind of we're all part of the same web. We are part of that network, and trying to showcase that while also highlighting real biodiversity hotspots that exist today and the peril that they're in.
Great. Well, that's been so great to talk to you, and
thanks
for sharing this awesome specimen with us.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see it on display in its place. It's going to be one of the objects as you enter the museum, when you come to Copenhagen and you enter our museum, as you go into the Biodiversity Gallery from One Direction, it is the object that will greet you, and you'll see it staring you right in the face, open maw and gory wound and all. It'll be so cool.
Yeah. So there we go, that's the end of episode 1 of our takeover. I really hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned for episode 2, where we'll be delving into more interesting specimen stories, such as deinstalling habitat dioramas, how to handle and preserve a massive dead Greenlandic shark in formalin, and discussion about a fossilized clam bigger than a bed,
as well as a host of other amazing specimen and treatment stories from our conservation unit. We hope to see you there.
C-Word, and today you've been listening to the team at the Natural History Museum in Denmark. You can find us on thecword.show or contact us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com or find us on social media. The intro and outro music is Spring by DD Mystic, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This is a Wooden Dice production.